This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming today, we'll start with Chance McNeely. He's the executive director of the Louisiana Motor Transport Association. He'll talk about the plight of truck drivers in our state. This industry provides 88,000 jobs in Louisiana, and there is a driver shortage and also some liability insurance issues that the industry is finding a challenge. Also, Mark Ballard, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Advocate, on the week at the Capitol as lawmakers head down the stretch and finish the regular session, much is happening, including a bar fight just yards away from the state capitol. Governor John Bel Edwards commented on this yesterday in his monthly show, and we'll talk about what happened, and we'll also hear from Tracy Fessenden in the long-awaited interview about Billie Holiday. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and your numbers are 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. Everywhere else, 877-217-5757. You can email us, talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Chance McNeely. He is the executive director of the Louisiana Motor Transport Association, an organization that's been the voice of the trucking industry since 1939. This is an industry in our state that is one of the largest, with 88,000 people employed. Chance McNeely, who has been involved in state government with the Department of Transportation and prior to that worked on Capitol Hill at the age of 30, has a big job, and it's good to have you in studio.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to be here.
Well, first of all, there was a bill in the legislature which failed, which would have kept truckers in the right lane, and a lot of people blame truck drivers for the traffic congestion we have in our state. Did your industry take a stand on this one?
We did, and we were very opposed to that bill, and I'm happy to tell you why. When you look at the interstates, particularly in Baton Rouge, you have a lot of exits that are very close together. You don't want trucks to be in the right-hand lane. It inhibits your ability to get on and off the interstate. You actually would have a wall of trucks to where you couldn't. It would make traffic worse, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And it came up, I think Steve Carter, who will be with us Monday, was the sponsor of that bill. And we have, obviously, a traffic issue, and you see a lot of trucks. But then again, those trucks are providing needed services for the people of our state. And I guess it's going after the low-hanging fruit.
It is, and Representative Carter is a good friend, and he cares about traffic in Baton Rouge. What I told him, and I'll tell everybody, if putting trucks in the right-hand lane would help congestion in Baton Rouge, the LMTA would have been all about it, because we want our trucks mm-hmm. to get through town with ease. If you think about it, next time you're on the interstate, look and see how many trucks are actually out there. The truck volume makes up a very small minority of the traffic. So there's a lot of commuter traffic on the interstates in Baton Rouge.
And right now you have a shortage of drivers.
That is correct.
You need more qualified drivers.
We do. Just, in the United States, we've got about a shortage of 50,000 today. That's going to grow over the next decade to probably about 175,000 drivers that we're short. And that's a major problem for us. And the reason is because, ultimately, the trucking industry is a good indicator of what's going on in the economy. So if the economy is growing, the trucking industry has to grow, because we move everything. And so if we can't get the drivers that we need to make that happen, then we kind of end up stifling the economy. That's the last thing that we want. We deliver mm-hmm. for a living, and we want to be able to do that.
What's the average day like for a truck driver? Obviously, many are on the road a lot. Some say there's sleep deprivation issues, and quite often they're driving most of the day into the night. What's the average day like for a driver on the road?
A driver on the road, it's not all that different than what you might expect. They spend a lot of their day stuck in traffic, and that's frustrating. They really, I think you're hitting on a key problem. These positions are not as attractive to folks as some other jobs that they could have. And so for our industry, it's a challenge for us, and we really need the ability to appeal to more folks. And we're not the only industry who has this problem, but there's a lot of alternatives for being a truck driver. And frankly, the public needs to be more appreciative of what a truck driver does for society.
How long generally are most drivers on the road before they take a break?
So they're on the road at least Yeah, well, let me back up. They take routine breaks. They have to, required by regulation. So they're heavily regulated. You know, sleep deprivation is something that the public talks about, but there are regulations in place that prevent that from happening. In fact, we just transitioned over to e-logs, and so now you have to log your hours electronically. So there's really no ability for a driver to fudge his numbers. So from a safety perspective, the federal government and LMTA supports this. You know, we've moved to e-logs, and that's something that's great for drivers. It's great for accountability. It's great for safety.
877-217-5757 for Chance McNeely, native of DeSoto Parish, who is now in Baton Rouge as the executive director of the Louisiana Motor Transport Association, organization that's been around since 1939. And truck drivers are in many ways unsung heroes. They're a big part of the commerce in this country. Just look at I-10 or I-12 and you'll see these drivers out on the road, and they're there for a necessity for the economy. And before they take a break, like, how many hours on the road is accessible, Chance? Some of these people, do they go 12 hours, 16 hours? So what's the limit?
It can vary, but they have to take breaks every so often. So they require that you sleep for certain periods of time. You're not going to be able to go, 12 hours consistently. Mm-hmm. There are lots of rules and regulations about that. I don't think that the public should be concerned about driver deprivation, particularly because of the new regulations that are out there. We have to electronically log our hours. And so that's a huge thing for the industry. It's good for the public. There's been some hiccups with that. I mean, frankly, not all of the trucking industry was excited to have to install this electronic equipment in their trucks. It costs money.
So they're monitored that way?
Correct. Yes, sir.
They can't fudge on that?
That's correct.
All right. Laura on Bluebonnet asks, is there an age limit? At some point when you're 60 or 70 or 80, can you be forced to stop driving, even if you're capable?
There's not, but there is an age limit that really hurts us, and that's the age at which you have to be to get your CDL for interstate commerce.
And what is that?
And that's 21. So what ends up happening is you graduate high school, 18 years old, you can't go get your CDL to be an interstate commerce trucker until you're 21. So in that three-year period, a lot of people have selected a trade other than trucking. They can't wait 3 years to go become, get into our field because they have to provide for themselves.
What would have to happen to change that to a younger age?
Well, that is a federal issue. On the state level, you can get your CDL if you're just driving inside the state. But the minute you engage in interstate commerce federally, it would take an act of Congress to get that age down from 21 to 18. And frankly, that is something that our national affiliate is looking at. I'm actually heading up to D.C. in 2 weeks to talk to the delegation, and that's one of the things that I'm going to be talking about is that, I understand the thought process behind having it 21 years old, but it's also a major limiting factor for our industry, and it's fueling this driver shortage that we've got.
In a career, how long does a truck driver usually last? This is a wear and tear type job. I would think that it's tough to do this for 30 or 40 years.
It may be tough to do it for 30, 40 years, but a lot of folks do it. And what I would say is that, the average truck driver is 49 years old right now. The average worker is actually in their mid to low 40s. So our drivers are a little bit older than the average worker. And they do typically go. You see a lot of drivers who are in their late 50s and into their 60s. And, that is an issue for us. We've got to appeal to the younger generation of folks. And, we've had pay increases in recent years. We hope that can continue. But it also, there are other limiting factors, such as the rising cost of insurance, that prevents us from being able to make the investment in our employees, but also in the equipment that would appeal to new employees. I mean, let's say, call it what it is. People would like to drive a new truck, a truck that has the modern amenities that exist.
Well, the average age is 49, and that includes the youngsters, those who are in their 20s. So that means that it is an aging industry. And this, let's face it, is not the healthiest occupation if you're not exercising. And I know some of them do. I see them out on the side of the road, but But for the most part, if you're preserving your energy and your attention for being on the road, you're not having an opportunity to get out and run and lift weights.
That is correct, and it's like a lot of, you know, I have an office job for the most part. I don't have that ability either. And so
you can walk around a little bit.
You're right.
I can't walk around right now. But
that's correct. But you hit on an important point. It is difficult for them to get cardio, you know, in their day-to-day work. And so health issues are a problem. Demographic issues can be a problem that makes trucking difficult. But at the end of the day, it's just such a necessity. We need folks to understand and appreciate the vital work that they do.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Chance McNeely, the executive director of the Louisiana Motor Transport Association. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yes. Did the trucking industry support Judge Gorsuch for a promotion to the Supreme Court because he had dissented in a case that said a company was liable for firing a truck driver who sought shelter rather than stay with the broken-down truck and freeze to death?
Well, I have to tell you, I don't know the answer to our National Trucking Association's position on the Supreme Court justice, unfortunately, but it's certainly something I'd be interested in looking into.
Well, truck drivers quite often are good Samaritans. I remember once having a flat tire in a snowstorm in Lake Village, Arkansas, of all places, and a truck driver actually stopped and helped me change that tire.
And there was actually a place up in the Midwest the other day where you saw a lot of trucks pull up to prevent somebody from committing suicide underneath a bridge. So the truckers do come together to do good things for folks.
We'll spend a few more minutes with Chance McNeely, the executive director of the Louisiana Motor Transport Association. Your number, again, is 877-217-5757. We always welcome emails at talk@talklouisiana.org. And we're back with more after this brief pause on WRKF. Or is the association? This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Chance McNeely with us for a little while longer, the executive director of the Louisiana Motor Transport Association, organization that's been around for almost 80 years, representing the trucking industry, the voice of the industry, and he is here to have his voice express the concerns and the challenges and, of course, the triumphs of people who drive the roads day after day and night after night. 877-217-5757. Jim in Denham Springs. Hi, Jim. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi. Let's talk about the new Tesla electric trucks and Walmart buying a fleet of them.
All right. That's a good topic. We've had guests on this show in recent vintage talking about how very soon we may have one truck leading a posse of trucks behind it. Tesla is, of course, on the cutting edge of this. What do you think?
So Tesla is doing a lot of innovative things that are exciting for the trucking industry. But what I want to tell you is that the next step in innovation is what we call platooning. And so platooning technology is where that lead truck and the truck right behind them can electronically connect to one another. And because they do that, they brake at the same time. They have radars coming off the side to where they see vehicles approaching. It's a lot safer. It allows them to enjoy better fuel efficiency because they're using the draft from the truck in front. And so that is the next step. We actually just passed legislation this year. It's been sent to the governor that allows the platooning technology to be used in Louisiana. And so we're proud of that. It's not, you know, at the end of the day, your large fleets are going to use that first. Mm-hmm. So think about a UPS, think about a FedEx. But ultimately, where you'd want to be is where all trucks could have this technology, and whether they're a member of the same fleet or not, they can, you know, platoon with one another into the future. And so we're excited about that.
Well, there, I'm sure, is a concern of some of the drivers that this could cost them jobs. If you've got one truck leading several others, then obviously there isn't a need for four or five drivers.
That is something that I've heard, but certainly with this platooning technology, I want to make one thing clear. It is driver-assisted. So the drivers are still there. They're still driving their trucks.
There'd be drivers in the trucks that are automated as well?
Correct. Correct. For the most, yes, as far as the right technology now, that exists right today. Now. I mean, at the end of the day, there's lots of talk about what may happen in the future with both vehicles and trucks. But I have to tell you, in the trucking industry, autonomous trucks without truck drivers are not something that we see forthcoming anytime soon.
You took it on the chin at the legislature on a couple of bills you were backing. What happened there?
We did. This year, we tried to take on what is the astronomical rising cost of liability insurance for the commercial trucking industry. And so in one bill, and it's a little complicated, but ultimately, if you're involved in a suit, and let's just say the trucking company is the defendant, we're being sued, you know, we have to pay for past, present, and future medical, as we should. The issue is that we end up paying what I would equate to the MSRP rate. So you get a bill for a medical procedure, but there are write-downs. Let's say it was $100,000, written down $50. You, as the plaintiff, actually owe $50, but the defendant is still on the hook for $100. So in that scenario, we paid $50,000 extra dollars that was never due to anyone. And so it's an inflated situation where that aspect drives up our insurance costs. And so that bill was in House civil law. We were not able to get it out. But I want to say this. We had 27 green cards in support of that bill and two red cards. And the two red cards were Trial Attorneys Association.
And this is an industry that is evolving like all others, and it is one that has been around a long time. I don't think we're going to have fewer trucks on the road. It's going to be something that will continue. What are the challenges you see in the immediate future?
Well, I mean, in the immediate future, it's exactly what we just hit on. It is the rising cost of insurance. At the end of the day, I have a member who told me the other day he got quoted to move his company to Texas. And if he did that, he would save $5,000 per truck per year if he just would domicile in Texas. That's, for him, that's $500,000 in profit that he's not getting because he's choosing to stay in Louisiana. And as long as that dynamic stays the same, we're going to see Louisiana-based companies have no choice but move to a neighboring state. And that's a bad place to be for Louisiana.
Well, we look forward to return engagement from you soon, and thanks for what you're doing. It's an important industry. Chance McNeely.
Thank you, Jim.
It's good to see you. And at the legislature, they're rounding the turn and heading down the stretch as the regular session ends, and a special session opens in 5 days on the 22nd. And today's advocate, if you look at the story above the fold, it's not about any kind of legislative activity. It's about what was going on a few blocks from the Capitol on Laurel Street at a bar called the River Room. And for those who were not there, this is apparently what it might have sounded like if you were at the River Room a couple of nights ago when Norby Chabert and Stuart Bishop exchanged pleasantries. The two lawmakers got into a fist fight just before 1 a.m. These guys are keeping long hours working for the betterment of our state. Both admitted hours later in their respective chambers to the fistic encounter, apologizing to members, constituents, and each other. Governor John Bel Edwards was on his show on this station yesterday. Allie, let's give a listen to what the governor said about this unfortunate encounter between Chabert and Bishop.
It's unfortunate. They're both good friends of mine. And by the way, they're good friends with one another. Every now and then, people become a little too passionate. And, you know, just like happens, I guess, in families and among friends, things can get out of hand. So it's unfortunate. But I know those two individuals, they're going to continue to work together, and I count them as friends of mine as well. And so it doesn't exactly reflect well on the House and the Senate and the legislature or state government, but I think it's something we can all forgive and get past.
And Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate, this was the buzz at the Capitol yesterday, wasn't it?
Yeah, they had a busy day, but there was an awful lot of chatter about the alleged fisticuffs that took place at that bar in downtown Baton Rouge. At one point, jokingly, they put a security tape around Representative Bishop's desk. Chabert was Senator Chabert was taking lots and lots of questions about it, you know, and there were all sorts of memes that were put up. It was just a lot of fun, and fun being the operative word, because everybody was making jokes about it. Though their apologies on the floor of the Senate and in the House were seemed sincere.
Well, this was a typical legislative fight. Nobody was hurt, and nothing was broken, and the police don't even have a record of a call, so it wasn't, as bar fights go, one that involved hospitalization and that sort of thing. But, Ali, let's hear Representative Bishop, who did comment on this.
I truly apologize if I did anything to upset y'all or make y'all look bad, because the integrity of this body is one thing that I cherish and I hold very dear.
Well, the River Room, 222 Laurel Street, is now going to be forever known as the place where Norby Chabert and Stuart Bishop duked it out. And I would imagine that they'll be okay. They probably may be better for friends now than they were before. This apparently was over a legislative issue, Mark Ballard.
It was. Now, you have to keep in mind that both are in comparable committees. One is over the environment in the House, and Chabert is over natural resources and environment in the Senate. And so they do a lot of work together, and, you know, they call each other friends, you know, and it's just, you know, it's a couple of Bayou boys that got in an argument over what the makeup of a one of the coastal restoration boards ought to be, whether or not there should be legislative members a part on it, and it apparently was an argument given the tenseness at the Capitol that we've been seeing for the last couple of weeks, given the late hour that this took place, and no doubt the number of drinks that preceded it. It became more, from what we understand, a kind of a shoving match.
Well, we'll talk more about this and more with Mark Ballard, who not only is trolling the Capitol, but he's down on Laurel Street as well. And we're back after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar, Becca Diller producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. The editorial page of The Advocate today reads, "No excuse for Louisiana lawmakers to come to blows over legislation." It's about a bar fight that, by bar fight standards, was rather tame between Norby Chabert, Senator, and Stuart Bishop, a representative. Nobody was hurt, seriously anyway. Maybe some feelings were hurt, but that's about it. But a listener notes, and I've just pulled up this story, 1906, just a block away, 263 3rd Street, now the home of the State National Life Building. Democratic Congressman George Favreau represented the 6th District in Louisiana, the one that now Garrett Graves represents, was set free after 5 months in jail after killing Dr. Joseph Aldrich, shooting him in the building. Aldrich had been his lifelong friend. The congressman declared the physician had made disparaging remark about Mrs. Favreau, the wife of the congressman. The shooting occurred immediately after an exciting election, and Favreau was still judge of the Baton Rouge court, which set him free. He resigned and was indicted, but he ended up serving his term in Congress after he was set free. So it's fortunate that we're not settling matters with bullets, as it was done in 1906. Mark Ballard, we've seen some lively action at the Capitol, but mostly it's just words and lots of words. But finally, at the finish line, some real matters are being resolved. And, for example, the non-unanimous jury verdict law would change if the voters of the great state of Louisiana decide to do it. This passed both houses rather convincingly with bipartisan support.
Yeah, that one seemed to be a pretty easy vote in that a number of prosecutors had decided that they were not that they had no problem with the unanimous jury verdict, given its history and how it came to be. And so it went through relatively easy, and so we'll see how it does when the state of Louisiana gets the vote on it. But that was one of the more important issues that made it through. Yesterday, we saw the Senate approve allowing felons to vote, and that was major. I mean, that's one of the big issues that has made it through. This is going back to the House for some minor changes that were made by the Senate, but it looks like it's well on its way.
24-13, the governor will have to decide on that, and that is a front-page story. Also, the Harris deal was approved by the legislature and now is in the governor's court.
It's I think it needs to go back to the House to take a look at some of the changes that were made on the Senate floor. But then it'll be going up to the governor's office, and he said that he's going to take a look at it and when it gets to his desk and decide if this is the best deal that we could possibly get, or do we need to stop, take a step back. He's looking at it in a way of is the deal worth, I mean, it worth waiting 6 years to get something similar, or is this the best deal that we're going to be getting? Something that we seem to miss, the Harris just kind of took over, but what is on the governor's desk is legislation that would allow the 15 riverboat casinos to move on land, and that kind of snuck through while we were all looking at Harris.
Yeah, that's a big one, and it was a big issue for the industry, and it has passed, and the governor's going to have to make the call on a lot of these, and through his first few years in office, he generally vetoes very few bills. I don't know if he's on the record as saying there's anything before him right now that he will stop.
Well, in general, the way he answers those questions, and we ask every time a bill goes up there, he says, you know, I need to read the bill and take a look at it before I figure out how I'm going to sign it or not. Even if it's, even from a 30,000-foot level that he agrees with the issue, he wants to look at what the actual language of the bill says.
So, well, a measure to criminalize abortions after 15 weeks is headed to the governor, and the governor has said that he is supportive of this.
Again, from a 30,000-foot level, he is supportive of the idea of putting a ban on abortions after 15 weeks and prosecuting those that perform abortions after 15 weeks. But he then will always step back, as he did on his show yesterday, and say, but I need to take a look at the language.
A Louisiana Senate-passed bill aimed at allowing public school teachers to join student-led prayer cleared the House 99-0 yesterday. 99-0. What does this bill do, Mark?
Well, it allows it's kind of a sort of a backdoor way of school prayer, because students can initiate their own school prayers, but there cannot be any kind of administrative involvement in it. They're allowed to do that now, and what this does is that allows it, as long as it's not administrative involvement, as long as it's a personal decision by people that work for the schools, that they can join in on those prayers.
An anti-hazing legislation, the so-called Max Groover Act, is on its way to Governor John Bel Edwards.
Yeah, that passed through very quickly last night. Basically, there were a couple of changes that were added by the Senate, and the House was okay. Chief sponsor of the bill, Nancy Landry, was okay with the changes, and now it's been passed. And what that will do is it will make it a lot easier for these hazing incidents to be prosecuted, and if they are successfully prosecuted, that the penalties are far stiffer than they have been.
The TOPS program, the much ballyhooed TOPS program, which every year faces challenges, it is going to be largely unchanged after an effort to make some tweaks fell short.
Yeah, I tried to keep up with the number of bills that had been filed for this particular session, and there may be a dozen of them that had made changes, significant and less so, in the in the TOPS program. None of them made it through. And this is after there was a year-long task force to kind of come up with ways to make the TOPS more economically sustainable. And it just proves, I guess, that this, you know, where once homestead exemption was the third rail of Louisiana politics, it now seems to be TOPS.
I love this headline in today's Advocate: Nursing Home Granny Cam Bill Passes Senate. What's the Granny Cam Bill?
Well, this came out of an actual case in which a patient of the nursing home died under circumstances that people were unsure of. I mean, how the injuries occurred. So they came up with a way to where you, as you know, the children, I guess, of a patient at a nursing home, can set up your own video streaming video camera in the room so that you can see how your parent is being taken care of in the nursing home. Now, the nursing home industry, of course, was way against this idea, but they kind of came to an agreement on, you know, how it has to be set up. You have to buy the camera. You have to buy the server in which it works, but you will be allowed to set up a camera and videotape and watch what the treatment is and what their day-to-day life is.
And you yesterday, while these other exotic issues were being debated and in many cases passed, Mark spent much of the day reviewing the state's construction budget.
Right. Well, I also have to edit all of the stories that come through, so I spend a lot of my day doing that, particularly now because there's so much stuff going on. But the construction budget, called capital outlay, if you want to use the term of art that they use in the state capitol, this is authorizes going out to find loan money, basically, but to sell bonds for various projects around the state. And in the past, traditionally, the legislators would just chock-a-block full this bill full of all sorts of stuff so that they could go home and say, you know, I got you that playground, even though that playground is so far down on the list that it wasn't going to be built in your lifetime. You could still brag about it. And what that led to was allowing the governor to go through and pick out the projects that would get funding, that would actually get money for it. What they've been trying to do, and Governor Edwards is supportive of this and had tried to do it when he was in the House as well, is to kind of pare down that list so that the legislature would actually decide which projects are going to get funded or have a much greater say in that. And it looks like this time around that they've gotten very close to doing that, and that is to line up the number of priority projects with the amount of money that would be available that they could loan. And they've gotten very close with that. And it's going up before the House for its final vote today.
What's the prognosis for the special session, which opens on the 22nd, which means next Tuesday?
Well, last night about 9:45, the House Speaker said that he was looking for a sine die, the end of this particular session on Friday, and that then we go into the special session on Tuesday. He also then said that if we don't get everything done, then we may go over the weekend. So the prognosis of that is that when we go into a special session on Tuesday, provided that they do adjourn the regular session, if they don't adjourn the regular session, there will be no special session. We'll have to go back and revisit that. If we do go into special session, mm-hmm. The focus is going to be trying to find enough money, about $648 million, to cover all of these kind of pretend budgets that you've been seeing floating around. Because if they can't find the $648 million, then some of these cuts will come to pass.
Well, Mark, it is always good to talk with you. Thanks for giving us your time today, and we'll be calling on you again next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate. As we head to the break, a listener notes that perhaps these lawmakers could take a cue from Coach O on bar fights. Ed Orgeron, the head coach of LSU, was arrested for charged with second-degree battery in a bar fight in 1992 in Baton Rouge. He acknowledged he had been intoxicated that night, had grown angry when not allowed back in to retrieve his credit card, and all heck broke loose. We're back after this pause.
My days have grown so lonely, for you I cry, for you.
That's the sound of Billie Holiday, the distinctive sound of the great jazz singer who died tragically at the age of 44, cirrhosis of the liver, and she had a rich life. Lady Sings the Blues. Remember that? That was about Billie Holiday. And she is now still being talked about and is a discussion point with many, not only in the music world, but elsewhere because of her impact on American culture. And we're going to join in just a moment Tracy Fessenden. Her book is Religion Around Billie Holiday. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest to join us now is Dr. Tracy Fessenden with the Arizona State University Department of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies. Her latest work is Religion Around Billie Holiday. Professor Fessenden is an expert on religious matters in our country, and this is an interesting approach to analyze the works of the soulful jazz singer, a legend, Billie Holiday, who died in the year of 1959. But she is remembered not only for her unique sound and troubled personal history, but a catalog that includes songs like Strange Fruit and God Bless the Child. You note, Professor Fessenden, that Billie Holiday had a major connection to the spiritual. How so?
Jim, it's so good to be with you. Thank you for inviting me. Billie Holiday is not someone that we typically think of as having a connection to religious life. For one thing, she didn't have that big church sound that we associate with so many of her contemporaries who came from what we would think of as the black church tradition that gave us gospel and blues. Singers like Mahalia Jackson, Aretha Franklin, Bessie Smith sound very different than Billie Holiday. But the premise of this book is that we can learn something important about Billie Holiday by looking at the religion around her, the religious currents that she navigated and whose influence she incorporated or resisted in her own work. And so I was very interested to learn that she herself had been raised in part in a convent, a Catholic convent reform school in Baltimore, and that she did incorporate elements of her Catholic upbringing into her life and her sound.
So her sound includes not only the echoes of black Southern churches, but also a Baltimore convent. I'm sure most people were unaware.
Yes, she was sent to the House of the Good Shepherd for colored girls, as it was known, twice between the ages of 10 and 12, and spent about a year there. And while she was there, she sang every morning a Catholic Mass at 6 a.m., according to the forms of Gregorian chant that had recently been renewed or revived in France in a way that makes them sound very modern. And I think that she was able to incorporate that rhythmic freedom that she learned at the House of the Good Shepherd into her sound. She was really one of the first jazz singers to do so. When we think about what makes jazz different from blues or other forms, it really is a relationship to the beat, a sense that in pop or rock, for example, as the great composer Ornette Coleman put it, everyone plays along to the beat of the drum, but in jazz, the drummer is one instrumentalist among others, which means everyone is liberated from a fixed metered beat. And that was something that the monks at Sonam, France, tried to do with chant, to liberate it from metered time, to make the metered time a thing of the spirit, as they said. And that's something that Billie Holiday picked up in her voice when she was still a very, very young girl. And we hear that really throughout her career. So many of the innovations she introduced into jazz singing and jazz in general, I think, come from that sense of rhythmic liberty.
She died at the age of 44 in 1959. It's fair to say that Billie Holiday, the former Eleanor Harris, had a full life.
Yes, she did. She did. She packed a great deal into her 44 years. And in fact, a couple of years before she died, Mike Wallace interviewed her and asked her why so many jazz greats die early. And that was what she said, that we try to pack too much into our lives. We try to live 10 years in a day. And she certainly did reach for many kinds of experience that in the end, I think, shortened her life, but left us such a brilliant legacy of music.
There were reports, Dr. Fessenden, that she was raped when she was young. She certainly had her battles with chemical dependency, died of what was termed cirrhosis of the liver. When did all this, as far as the bad aspects of her life, when did it spiral out of control?
That's a good question. It's hard to put an exact pin on when that might have happened. And I think it's important to credit Billie Holiday for maintaining an incredible level of artistic discipline, even as she dealt with very, very punishing personal circumstances. The rape that we read about in Lady Sings the Blues, her autobiography that she co-wrote with the journalist William Dufty, was part of a trafficking proceeding that sent her back to the House of the Good Shepherd for a second time. But at that time in her life, she was not yet 12. She she was living with pimps and madams who regularly exploited her and was no stranger to the sexual aspect of the good time culture in Prohibition. She sang in brothels. She was also very probably exploited as a prostitute in those places. So she, from a very, very early age, had a great deal to contend with. When we think about the history of her sound, the periods in which her records are normally categorized, we recall a very fresh, light, lilting, joyful early period that then becomes darker and more somber as she grows older and perhaps had less ability or success or interest in transcending or evading some of the darker aspects of her own personal history. But that she did so, that she was able to make incredible music, even in the face of all of these forms of trauma, I think is an extraordinary achievement.
Did she find solace in the midst of all this chaos and turmoil in her life? Did she find solace in her religious beliefs?
I don't know that she found solace in her religious beliefs, and that's not my primary interest in this book. She certainly did maintain a connection to Catholicism. She prayed the rosary. She had a prayerful relationship to St. Teresa, who was her patron in the convent. She took the name of Teresa in the convent. But I'm interested more in how she may have dealt with that upbringing as a singer. And I think if she found solace, Jim, it was in her music and in her great gifts, in her talent. I don't know that it was a kind of religious solace, as that might be familiar to most of us, but certainly she knew how gifted she was. And one of the things that William Dufter reports after her death is that she knew people would be listening to her for as long as records are made, for as long as we have ears, because she was really singing for eternity. She wasn't singing for this audience or that audience or to make a lot of money. She never had very much luck with money. But she had a sense that she was singing, I think, in sacred time, and that is something that I hope consoled her. I hope she did take comfort in that knowledge.
The book is Religion Around Billie Holiday, and there is a fabulous photograph on the cover of Tracy Fessenden's book. And I note that it was taken April 24th, 1959, at the Storyville nightclub in Boston. And to put that in perspective, that was less than 3 months before she died.
Yes, Jim, I'm so glad that you note that. You know, when we look at photos of Holiday late in her life, it's easy for many of us to observe the wear and tear that she was dealing with by that point in her life. And, of course, her health was in and out. Her addictions laid her low for long periods. But in that photo, she looks absolutely radiant, absolutely gorgeous. And I think that signals her special relationship to the music she's making, to the art that she so gorgeously perfected. And that picture was taken by a fan who was there in the audience, a guy named Mel Levine, who left the photographs in a drawer, and his kids found them after his death and let me use them for the book. Oren Levine and Noam Levine made that photo available to me, so I want to thank them. It is an absolutely gorgeous photo.
And no discussion of Billie Holiday would be complete without mentioning New Orleans.
That's right. That's right. She made a film called New Orleans and starred alongside Louis Armstrong. And it was a lamentable film, unfortunately, in terms of the storyline and the production values. But who would ever miss a chance to see Louis Armstrong and Billie Holiday in a film together? So that film is worth seeing. Maybe just turn the sound on and don't pay too much attention to the plot. She didn't spend a time in New Orleans, as far as I can tell. She came through once or twice, but it was not a place where she was formed. And yet, at the same time, I think the reason jazz sounds the way it does is because New Orleans did incubate a kind of sound in the midst of all of these various religious and racial currents that also converge in Billie Holiday's life. And so that, of course, is what makes the sound of jazz different from the sound of blues, the sound of gospel, that we have not only a black church sound, but we have black and white Catholic sounds, we have Caribbean sounds, we have Jewish lyricists and composers contributing their particular gifts to this music, and all of those currents also were a part of Billie Holiday's life.
Well, it's a fascinating book and an important one, Religion Around Billie Holiday, from Tracy Fessenden. Congratulations, Dr. Fessenden.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Our guests include Miss Wheelchair Louisiana, Karen Roy, who's down at the Capitol recently commenting on potential budget cuts and how it could affect handicapped people in our state. And, of course, she has an amazing backstory to tell. We've heard her before, but it never gets old to hear her remarkable comeback from being shot outside the old Tabby's Blues Box in September of 1987 and then becoming the mother of a few children and living a full life, and she is an amazing survivor. Also, Pam Bordelon on the Royal Wedding. The Advocate Society columnist will come in on what's happening across the pond with the world watching. We'll talk about it with Pam Bordelon. For Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.